This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, who invites you to attend HomebrewCon this June 27th through June 29th in Providence, Rhode Island. It's the biggest homebrew event of the year, held in the smallest state. Learn more and register at homebrewcon.org. That's homebrewcon.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 18th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Doug Rosinski joins us to talk about his adventures in using kombucha as a starter for kettle-soured beers and other sour fermented foods. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint and our Basic Brewing rainbow shirt. Our shop is still under construction, but I am assured that it will be back online soon. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com and found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you'd do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that that'll help new listeners to find us. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a list of the stuff, a long list of the stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter, including financial supporters. This past week got an early release, a recipe, and behind-the-scenes video of our upcoming Basic Brewing video episode on my no-chill room-temperature Helles. It's a super simple but super tasty beer made even more easy by using the no-chill technique. It's 100% German Pilsner malt, and some may think there's the danger of encountering corny DMS off flavors by racking that hot wort straight into a no-chill container and screwing on the lid. But at least in this example, those skeptics' worries would be unfounded. The beer is as clean as a whistle. The general public will see that video this Friday. Also this Friday, financial supporters will be seeing an early release recipe and behind-the-scenes video of my Instant Pot IPA. Now, this beer also turned out to be tasty, but I would tweak this recipe a bit on this one. It turned out a little sweet, but delicious anyway. And the behind-the-scenes video in this episode has a bit more information on the whole process that I went through, more information than what I put on the finished episode. So brewing with the Instant Pot was different from other small batches that I've brewed of a similar size. Coming up to strike temperature was more tricky. Maintaining mash temperature was tricky as well. Also, the pot boiled off more water than I expected, so I had to improvise. But the bottom line is that you can use the Instant Pot for an all-grain batch of beer. And as I said, financial supporters will see that this upcoming Friday, and the general public will see it a week later. And thanks to everybody who's chipping in with Patreon and such. Also chipping in this week as a sponsor are fine folks at Tavor. You've heard me talk about them on the show. Tavor is a way to select delicious craft beers that you may not be able to find in your area and have them delivered directly to you. It's not a beer of the month club where somebody else chooses the beer for you. You only pay for the beer that you choose over the course of the month. So signing up for Tavor is free. Just create an account at Tavor.com. That's T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com. And download their iPhone or Android app. You'll receive notifications for two new beers each day that are available for purchase with in-depth tasting notes from Philip at Tavor. In April, for example, look for beers from breweries like Pipeworks, Weldworks, Castle Island, Yazoo, and Five Threads. If you're not interested in any of those, no worries. Just skip the ones that you don't want. However, when you see something that you do want, and you will, believe me, don't wait. Just click to get it and add it to your crate. Your beer arrives fresh every few weeks, allowing you enough time to fill a box and pay the least shipping, which is handy. Why don't you check it out? It doesn't cost anything to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase anything. In fact, if I can ask you a favor, go to Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, or download the app. And when you sign up, enter the promo code BASICBREWING, all one word, and you'll get $10 off your first shipment of $25 or more. Again, it's free to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase. Sign up at Tavor.com or with the Tavor app and enter Basic Brewing as the promo code. And you can also follow them on Instagram as well. Tavor posts pictures of cool beers that they're featuring. And thanks to Tavor for being a regular sponsor now of the show. Yesterday, I brewed up three small batches for an upcoming hop sampler show. I used Green Bullet, Cashmere, and Saz, or is it Zatz, or is it Zatz? To me, Zatz is a bridge too far, even if it's correct. I just feel goofy saying Zatz. It's like my friend that I grew up with, who now lives in Italy and is fluent in Italian because he's lived there so long. When he comes back over here to visit, he says things like pistachios. Well, I don't care if it's right or not. I'm not going to walk into Walmart and ask where I can find the pistachios. I'm going to say pistachios while I'm over here. And if I'm ever back and visiting him in Italy, I'll try the other way. You know, maybe I'll say pistachios over there. But anyway, Zatz, I don't know. What do you think? Anyway, I'm looking forward to tasting how those beers turn out. I also kegged my No Chill Belgian-style golden ale, and this one had a bunch of hops added at the end of the boil before I transferred it into the No Chill container. Did the hops maintain their juicy hop aroma and flavor? I won't spoil the results of my batch, but I'd like to hear from other No Chill brewers out there. Does No Chilling affect the character of your hops that are added at the end of the boil? Drop me a line at james@basicbrewing.com to let me know. I got an email from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. They're having a sale on their Warthog electric brewing systems, but you have to act fast. The sale ends April 21st. You can save $100 on any Warthog electric system. The $100 discount would be applied automatically at checkout. You know I love my Warthog system from High Gravity. Mine is a 10-gallon batch, 240-volt brew-in-a-bag system. But you can find Warthog systems from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels in single, double, and 3-vessel configurations. And from now until April 21st, you can get $100 off your dream Warthog system. And High Gravity takes the pain out of propane with excellent electric gear. And also now, they're retailers of awesome Spike brewing gear, so you can ramp up your system even further. Check it all out at highgravitybrew.com and get kitted out for the summer brewing season at highgravitybrew.com. Okay, longtime listeners to the Basic Brewing Radio Archives will recognize Doug Wierzynski. He's a homebrew hero in Utah, having been on the forefront of legalizing our hobby in his state and arguably starting the chain reaction that led to legalization of the remaining states, where it was still forbidden by law at that time. He was also a hero of sorts to our family when we were stranded overnight by weather and an airline, which shall be unnamed, in Salt Lake City a couple years ago. Doug and his wife Sarah rescued us from our motel and treated us to grilled brats and homebrew at their house. While our sons played video games together, that was a really fun evening. It turned a sour experience of getting stranded into a really fun, memorable experience. So that is an experience that would not have happened without this silly podcast. Anyway, Doug wrote me recently that he's been playing with using kombucha as a starter for several things, sour and fermented, at his home. And I was glad to use that as an excuse to get back together and catch up. Doug Wierzynski, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
It is a pleasure to be back. How are you, James Tiberius Spencer?
I'm well.
Good. The Star Trek people will get that.
Yes. Yes, they will. I've met William Shatner.
Have you?
Did you know that?
I did not.
I paid to meet him. It wasn't a Oh. He's got this one-man show that he tours around the country. And,
was that like the tour he used to do with Spock in like the 70s where they would do this the sort of beatnik style poetry?
No, no, I'm sorry, I missed that. Oh. But no, this is he walks around or walks around the stage and tells stories of you know his early acting days and things like that and the days of Star Trek and whatever and T.J. Hooker and whatever comes into his mind. And then afterwards, you pay a certain amount of money for a signed poster and a photograph with yourself.
Nice.
And I wore a red shirt to the event. And I got a chuckle out of him because I said, does it make you nervous that I'm wearing a red shirt? Or is it a good thing that I'm wearing a red shirt to meet you? And he said, we'll take care of you. We'll protect you.
So. Yeah, it's a wonder he's still alive.
It's always a danger. So we're on the line for 30 seconds. We're already off on a tangent.
Sure enough.
So we haven't talked. Have we talked since you know in a duplex fashion since we dropped in on your residence back a couple of years ago?
You know, aside from a couple of emails, not so much. But life has advanced, and life is good here in the great state of Utah. You know, if I may, I will plug the Pink Boots Society. Our mutual longtime friend, Jamie Burnham, is the chapter leader here in the great state of Utah for female brewers, professional brewers. And so I've been enjoying on Wednesdays, We Wear Pink Boots beer. That was a collaboration with a few professional breweries, and they do good work, and they're really some pretty fierce female professional brewers in the state of Utah.
Well, cool.
Yeah,
I follow Jamie on Instagram, and I've seen pictures, and so I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, she's kicking it. She really, I mean, she's too cool for me now. We used to be tight, but you know. She went to a couple different breweries, and she's just hit her stride, so I'm proud of her.
Yeah, well, I owe Jamie a debt of gratitude. Without Jamie, the basic brewing endeavor might not have been as successful as it turned out to be, because she was one of the early adopters, over at the Beer Nut, and putting our DVDs in their homebrew kits, their equipment kits, so...
And that is precisely how I found out about you.
Well, there you go. It all comes around. Everything revolves around Jamie.
Well, yes, I'll give her that. She's definitely part of my home brewing and professional brewing universe. Well,
there you go. Virtual toast to Jamie Burnham.
Cheers. Yes.
Now, I have to sip. I've got a homebrew golden ale, a Belgian golden here. No chill. I'm on a no chill kick. And so that's what I've got on tap. What are you drinking?
It's the it's actually a beer called On Wednesdays We Wear, I think, Pink Boots, and it is that collaboration beer that the Pink Boots Society Utah chapter did as a collaboration brew.
Oh, so it's the actual beer.
Yeah, I picked it up, and it's tasty. It did a session IPA to sort of as a nod to the grocery store limit of Utah. Grocery store beer, which is 3.2%.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's definitely sellable in grocery stores, but I happened to pick mine up at one of the local breweries that participated in the joint brew.
Well, there you go. Tangent number two.
Number two.
For those keeping score.
I got a third. You know, let's just drag this out. Do you know what is being celebrated for 10 years now in the great state of Utah?
10 years?
10 years.
I'm afraid to ask.
Well, if my math is right, I'm pretty sure homebrewing was legalized in the great state of Utah in 2009. And here we are, 2019.
That boggles the mind.
Right?
That's nuts. It can't be a decade.
Well, maybe not. I mean, I could be completely off. I don't know. My facts are questionable.
I don't doubt you. You would know better than I. Wow. That's amazing. That does not seem like 10 years ago. Mm. Life is going by way too fast.
Yes, it has.
The cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon. So, after tangent number three, and congratulations, okay. By the way, virtual cheers again to that.
Saw you.
Using tight. Now, you emailed me saying that you had an interesting concept involving kombucha.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've talked about kombucha on this show a couple times.
Sure.
And I've played with kombucha, and I've even did a kettle sour with a kombucha beer. Mm-hmm. But you have you're using a concept that takes kombucha sort of to the next level. What are you doing?
Well, I guess the concept is that kombucha can be the root of all starters. I derived this inspiration from a book called Wild Fermentation, and it basically talked about how, you can transfer, some of these souring, pickling starters from thing to thing. And Sarah had come home and my wife Sarah had come home one day and had this recipe for fantastic kombucha that her friend at work had been making, and they all loved it. And so we started, doing two batches every week. So Sunday was our kombucha brew day. And, I love kombucha. I like kombucha. And it can get – it's not a beverage that I drink every day in great volume. So when you're making it almost every week, it definitely leads to some kombucha fatigue. And you got to find ways to use it. And in drawing on the inspiration from that book, I thought, let's try and spread the love a little bit and find new ways to use this. And I have employed that kombucha as a form of starter for a number of different things, including but not limited to a sourdough bread starter. Mm. And currently, I'm working on sauerkraut, which was inoculated with my tea kombucha. The fundamental theory is that black tea kombucha, when it's fermented out, is extremely versatile, and it's fairly neutral. You can add a responsible portion of that to just about anything you would like to see fermentation take off. And it will do so without adding a major impact to the final product.
Hmm. Well, let's not get too ahead of ourselves.
Sorry.
What is your kombucha recipe? What's your technique for making the kombucha in the first place?
Hmm. Fair enough. I'm of the school of thought that transferring SCOBYs themselves is not the primary method for transferring the active organisms involved or critters. So I like to move a portion of the actual liquid. So I think Sarah had come home with a form of a starter, and we split it and made it into two large batches. And so basically, hers had some orange flavor to it, and it was the more customized form of kombucha, a little less flexible in terms of its use. But I just wanted to go straight black tea, sugar, and a starter. And it took off like a rocket, and it was doing great. And I've been able to find some uses. And I've actually found uses for Sarah's orange-flavored kombucha as well.
Hmm. So how much tea and how much sugar and what volume?
Oh, I think we're doing, a half cup per gallon. Mm-hmm. Of a mix, and then when I'm doing a full gallon, I use 10 tea bags.
Okay, so that sounds about what Phil Nagash recommended on the show a while back, about half a mm-hmm. cup of sugar. And I can't remember, I measured the specific gravity, and it seems like it was like 10, 20 maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, that seems a bit high, but. I think mine was lower, but of course I draw my inspiration from Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video. So, I'm sure that ratio came in precisely from you.
It could be, I could be wrong, but it doesn't have to be way sweet for the kombucha to do its stuff.
No, not at all.
So do you get a SCOBY, I guess, on top of the kombucha as it goes along, right?
Oh yeah, and the longer I leave it, it seems like the bigger it gets. It's really sometimes, and I actually use a pretty wide diameter jar for my kombucha, and so we're looking at, like, you know, 10 inch diameter SCOBY, and sometimes it's gotten close to an inch in thickness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've used the technique of just pouring more sweet tea on top of existing, you know, SCOBYs, and there's like a stacked pancake thing going on. but it seems like, or it sounds like, you sort of do you kind of clean the jar after every pitch and get rid of the existing SCOBY?
I do get rid of the existing SCOBY. I throw that out on almost a weekly basis because it's sort of the same premise, right? Some of the organisms in there are oxygen dependent, and just like a pellicle, you know, acts as a preserving layer, a protective layer. I figure the SCOBY does the same thing, and it can perhaps slow down that aerobic fermentation that's taking place. So no matter what I'm doing, I'll get rid of the SCOBY once a week and let it start over from scratch, and then, you know, add as necessary for volume.
Now, for those new to kombucha, or the theory of kombucha, it's this soured tea drink, and the SCOBY that we're talking about stands for symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. Mm-hmm. So we're not really sure what's in there. It's got bacteria and yeast in it, but
it tastes good, it's good.
Yeah, it could be a lot of stuff in there. In, you know, a lot of times in home fermentation, it's kind of like, well, it worked, so it worked. Yeah. So you don't worry so much about it. So you just use the liquid from one project to another. So let's go through some of these things, and imagine we'll talk about beer at some point in the process.
Sure.
Let's talk about, for example, sourdough. How do you use and you can just use I think like the air, you know, to sour a lot of these things, like sauerkraut. You know, it uses the stuff that's already on the cabbage and just salt to calm things down. But what about sourdough bread? How do you use the SCOBY in that, or the kombucha in that?
Well, so to start with, I as strange as this may sound, I use the kombucha tea as sort of a safety measure, right? Because as you said, cabbage can be fermented because it's got the organisms on the leaves, and you just got to add some salt, and it'll extract the water, and it'll be fine. Same thing goes for flour. The organisms that are on the flour, you know, that are there can be added. You know, you can add water to them, and you can build up a sourdough, and you can add things from your garden if you want to try and make a very local, you know, terroir of a sourdough. And even so much with, you know, wild fermentation, but you run the risk every time that you might not get what you want, right? You know, sometimes your sourdough can go completely sideways on you when you're trying to build it up. And sometimes you can get a little worried that your sauerkraut hasn't really developed the environment that you need, because essentially all these wild fermentation foods require a couple of things. They require a drop in pH and some nominal amount of alcohol, and the two combined provide a protective environment to prevent any, you know, untoward organisms to jump in. So I do that in terms of very specifically with my sourdough, because I have had failed sourdoughs that were, you start with, you know, equal volumes, if you will, of water and flour, and you blend the two, and you can start very small when you're doing your own starter. You're trying to build it up from scratch. And so you're relying basically on what's on the flour, and maybe whatever you know, if you've got some grapes growing in your backyard, and you drag them through there to try to introduce what you want to have in terms of your sourdough. But of all the various fermentations I've ever done, sourdough seems to have the highest fail rate, because you got to smell it. You've got to make sure. And if it just doesn't seem like it's coming along great. You got to basically start over. And what I have found is that because that SCOBY has, you know, both bacteria and yeast, and you can actually see how the yeast hangs, it'll still top ferment in some form underneath the SCOBY. And so my approach has been, you know what, if I take a portion, the same volume of water that we were supposed to do is sort of that one-to-one volume ratio for a sourdough starter, but you, instead of using water, you use some kombucha, you are immediately introducing a lower pH environment. And because you've presumably enjoyed your kombucha and it tastes proper, then it's got the right mix of organisms. And when I blend them together and let it go, and you can build it up over time, sort of, you know, the traditional way of building up a sourdough starter is like a quarter cup of flour, a quarter cup of water, and you add up that every day, and then occasionally pour some out so that you can keep building it up and develop the flavor. And traditionally, that can take quite a while, a couple weeks, maybe more. But when you've already have that group of organisms, the yeast and the bacteria and all those things that are in there in your kombucha that are making it taste awesome, if you can transplant all of those right into your sourdough starter, and it really shortens the wait time associated with it. And I've been able to go from zero sourdough starter to making sourdough bread in about a week, because I'm already introducing the critters that are responsible.
So every day, do you add, after you put the kombucha as a starter, do you add, instead of adding equal amounts of water and flour each day after that, you just add equal amounts of kombucha and flour?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you continue with the kombucha.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So sauerkraut, I have made several batches of sauerkraut, and I had one batch that got a little hairy on the top of it, and and I actually sent a picture to Michael Tonsmeyer and said, does this look normal? And he kind of gave a noncommittal response with something like, you know, home fermentations are sometimes, interesting or something. So I decided to ditch that one just because, I'm not going to feed weird stuff to my family that I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. So, home fermentation is sometimes goes a little wacky. Right. So how do you use kombucha as a starter in sauerkraut to help things along?
Well, so along the same lines, I actually got my original recipe for doing sauerkraut at home from Michael Tonsmeyer when he was doing his Mad Fermentationist blog. And in my personal experience, when I added the appropriate amount of salt to the weight of sauerkraut, I'd always wind up needing to add a little bit of water to make sure that the sauerkraut and the weight was covered to provide that protective, oxygen layer. And having been comfortable with that, knowing that happens a lot in over several batches. I mean, bear in mind, I'm Polish, and so sauerkraut is a part of our diet staple, especially this time of year. And so I've made plenty of it over the years, and it seems like I always need to add a little extra water to make sure that the sauerkraut gets started or covered, excuse me. And so I applied the same concept of the kombucha starter to sauerkraut. And so instead of waiting a couple of days to realize that the water needed to be higher and adding it, I just acknowledge up front, you know what? I know I'm going to need a little extra liquid to make sure that the sauerkraut gets covered. I use the same amount of salt by weight, which I think is something akin to 2.2%. Weight ratio of cabbage to
salt to cabbage. Yeah.
Right.
2% salt to cabbage. The other way around wouldn't be as tasty, I don't think.
Oh, no, you're right. I'm sorry. Well, whatever. Maybe you like that. I do live next to the Great Salt Lake. We are big fans of salt here. But basically, we're trying to I add that up front, and I know what I'm doing is that even though I'm confident that having done previous batches, that the right critters that are resident on the leaves of the cabbage will eventually get the job done. I'm using kombucha as something of an insurance policy and an accelerator by adding that right when I go into the crock, and I know that I'm getting that mix of, you know, wild yeasts and funky critters and bacteria and whatnot, and it has always just picked things up a little bit, made it a little faster, and it's been very convenient.
Now, do you get a more interesting flavor out of the cabbage with the kombucha in there?
No, you know, the funny thing is maybe I have a very simple palate, but I have never with any of these things detected that there's some black tea note in the background. I view a plain kombucha as a very neutral source of starter, and so basically you're moving in with all the right things, because when we take a step back and look at all these various wild fermentations, we're relying on the same critters, the same yeast, the same bacteria to do what we need in these various applications. But it's all very similar mix. It's a biome. Mm-hmm. And so when I view it as, listen, I can take, my kombucha is a massive starter, and I can apply that in a variety of ways. And I think the end product is the flavor that you expect. I mean, the cabbage has the character that you want from sauerkraut. It tastes the way it's supposed to. No one would ever guess that I did anything other than a traditional fermentation. But what I've done is I've made sure that nothing went sideways. My sauerkraut didn't get fuzzy and furry or whatever. And the same thing goes for, you know, just about anything else I've employed it for. It just gives it a head start, especially with that sourdough starter. It really cuts the time down. And I have noticed that even if I'm in a hurry, I can use some of that, you know, a very young sourdough slurry that I've introduced it with kombucha, because it's already, that kombucha has the acidity in place, right? You're adding the flavor of the kombucha, not necessarily the tea so much, but the tart notes that you would expect from a kombucha, and you can mix that with some yeast. And frankly, James, I've done it in 24 hours. I have one day mixed the two together, let the yeast and the kombucha, you know, get to know each other for 24 hours. And the fermentation happens pretty quick, that you can see the layer and bubbles build up, and then moved straight into a sourdough. Now, yeast and sourdough can be a little trickier. So I will say that I have done the belt and suspenders approach. If I rush the sourdough starter, then I do throw in some traditional bread yeast just to make sure that I get the rise that I need and the time that I'm working it. But even when I do that, I still get that nice sourdough character, you know, in the taste and in the aroma of the bread. It's really quite fun.
Now let's move this into the beer world.
Let's do it.
How have you used kombucha as a starter with beer?
Well, I've done it in a very relatively small total volume. I've been drawing some inspiration from, again, your material, and have used my Instant Pot to do some micro batches. And I have been generous with using the amount of kombucha in terms of the total volume necessary to make a kettle sour style Instant Pot homebrew. So I will admit that in terms of homebrewing, you may have, you know, results may vary. If you're doing like a 5-gallon batch and you're trying to pull kombucha in to do it, you'll probably need more time to let the organisms populate and do what they need to do to get the correct flavor. But in using it in small, very small batches, you know, a pint basically of kombucha and top up the necessary water with depending on how much you're doing in that Instant Pot, will essentially do the same thing. And then you can when you feel like that flavor's where it's supposed to be, you can just then switch over to the boil, and you'll denature all the stuff that's in there, and you'll lock in that sourness level the way you want it.
Yeah, there are a lot of people when they're doing kettle souring will pre-acidify the wort by using acid malt to bring the pH down a bit, even before they add the lactobacillus. Sure. So adding the kombucha might have a similar effect.
I think so. I mean, you know, I have not done pH meter reading. I've never been comfortable with the calibrating those machines, but I agree. I think that you're introducing a liquid that has a low pH and just a slight amount of alcohol in it. And I think that does help stabilize, you know, that kettle souring period. I mean, I've used acid malt in a various number of brews over the years, and there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it does add a good character, but I don't know that's necessary, mainly because in my experience, I have not used acid malt in my kombucha kettle soured homebrew.
Yeah, I've not used acid malt in any of my kettle soured adventures either. And things generally turn out all right. And I've used the SCOBY of a kombucha to kettle sour a 1 or 2 gallon batch of beer. In the first attempt, it turned out really good. I tried to repeat it, and it turned out wacky. And that was with just plopping a pancake of SCOBY in there. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the yeast was more predominant in that one because it took off actually fermenting. There was an active fermentation. It wasn't just kettle souring at that point. So I'm not sure what went different, but it was smelling, you know, different at that point. And so, I decided to derail that and put the brakes on it and try something else. But maybe in using, maybe that SCOBY or that pancake of stuff, some people say, you know, the SCOBY refers to the entire population of right. microorganisms throughout. It's not just the solidified gel stuff at the top. It's, you know, it's the culture of the entire stuff throughout the liquid.
Sure.
Maybe the pancake of stuff that I put in there was more yeast heavy than the initial one that I did. I don't know, and it seems like maybe using the liquid kombucha might be a way to get something that's more homogeneous and repeatable and dependable. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely subscribe to the school of thought that the SCOBY itself. That pancake is not the source of the magic, and I routinely pitch those. And if somebody comes to me and asks for a starter for kombucha or whatever, what I will always do is remove the SCOBY and basically agitate the whole pot, because most of the time when you make kombucha, you can see there's a sediment layer, which is not sugar, and you're putting nothing else in there besides tea and water. So that's, it seems like that's dormant yeast that has been doing its job and then settled out. So I'll stir that up and I'll deliver that as a package, or I'll use that as my starter in the various food applications. And it's really generated pretty consistent results.
Now, since the SCOBY is a collection of different microorganisms, and we're not exactly sure what it is, mm-hmm. how, when you're doing a kettle souring, usually, you know, you pitch a pure culture of lactobacillus in some form or another, either it's a probiotic or it's, you know, something right. from a yeast manufacturer or something like that. When you are pitching this kombucha starter in there, you are introducing a bunch of different stuff in there potentially. So right. how do you know that you're not going to wind up with something more funky than you want? Say, you know, maybe vinegar, or maybe, you know, something more akin to what you can get, you know, on a weird sour mash brew.
So is this where you put the legal disclaimer in about
You're the lawyer.
No, I mean, you trust your palate, honestly. So if your kombucha tastes good and you like and it's fine, it's not making you, you know, sick to your stomach or whatever, which I've never had, then you can trust it to basically repopulate other areas of your wild fermentation or your non-traditional fermentation for foods and beverages. I personally just, you know, look towards making sure I have a stable kombucha. I've never just done a brand new kombucha and a week later started using it for everything. I let it go a couple of, or at least a week, maybe a little more, especially when you're first starting out, and taste it. And you should expect there's going to be a level of acidity that you're comfortable with. And that's, you know, again, it's a very palate driven thing, especially with kombucha. You're going to, when you taste the acidity that you want, you need to be able to take out a portion of it and then backfill it with fresh, unfermented sugary tea. And then again, taste it as it goes up. You know, you may very well, personally, I think that vinegar, the status of vinegar is really a function of time. Mm. With kombucha in particular, we've actually let this happen where if you let kombucha ride long enough, the acidifying critters are going to keep working. And gradually it will turn from kombucha into something very acidic and vinegary, which I've taken that and run with it too. And I've made some very cool custom flavored vinegars for various applications, whether it be like Chinese food and rice or any number of applications. So there's really no way to go wrong because, you know, let's face it, like I said before, nobody can drink a lot of, well, maybe some people do, but I don't. I don't drink kombucha at a level where a weekly brewing process really is sustainable. So that was this inspiration for my whole experiment, which is, well, how do I use this stuff if I'm not drinking it? And I've added it to foods. I've added it to beer. I've definitely pulled some off and made it into a vinegar. And it's all been very tasty.
So one would think with the kettle souring process, you're only going like a couple, 3 days, right? Until you get down to the acid level or the tartness level that you're comfortable in moving on. And, you know, with the pasteurizing or boiling the wort, so it doesn't seem to me that using this technique, you might accidentally come up with vinegar in like 2 days, right?
No. Because I think it'll take far longer for the critters involved to convert sugars and produce the acidic flavors that would cross over into a vinegar level. And you know what? You want to hear something crazy?
Sure.
All right. So
I'm in. I've had 3/4 of a pint of golden ale. I'm ready.
All right, let's do it. So kombucha is soured stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So like just like I said, I can do a sourdough starter very quick because I'm using the flavors and the character that the kombucha has developed on its own and basically letting it happen to, you know, mixing it with some yeast and some fresh flour. And I can get that character without giving the organisms in that sourdough starter really a big chance to develop that character. And in fact, in some cases, if I use a lot of that kombucha as a complete replacement to water in bread making, you know, that I have received some pretty good compliments about that sourdough character, although the dough itself has had no time to sour. So the same thing goes. I mean, if you're making, you know, as in my case, I've got a thing that's like 3 gallons large and can make as much of that in a week as I want. There's nothing stopping you. If you let that sour enough where you like the character of that kombucha, you don't even need to kettle sour. You can just use that in larger volume. And again, I'm thinking in the context of an Instant Pot, but you can move that liquid over and replace it one for one with water, and it almost boil right away, and you'll get the acidity because it doesn't leave, and you basically have considered your kombucha a kettle sour starter, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. and put it to work right away.
Yeah, I've heard of hybrid, beer kombucha beverages out there where people have combined the two, and why not? If it tastes good, go for it.
Right. And that's the whole point, right? If you like the way your kombucha tastes, then it's probably safe to use in any number of applications. And depending on how intense you want the flavor, the more kombucha you use.
Now, you probably don't want to pour, some active kombucha into, say, a barrel. You wouldn't pour it into a beer that you're barrel aging, would you?
Oh, well, yeah. See, you're testing my limits. I'm talking a big game about being able to use kombucha for anything, but no, I would not. But only because I have never done it, and I know what it takes to brew enough beer to fill a 55-gallon barrel, because I have done my Solera brewing method, and I would not roll the dice on that level. But it's all about your risk tolerance. I guess if you wanted to do it yourself, send us an email, let me know. You're willing to risk, a month of Sundays of homebrewing to fill up a wooden barrel and inoculate it with some kombucha.
Yeah. It seems like to me that there's a risk. I mean, and I'm getting just to the edge of my knowledge here, so I may be stepping into the abyss, but it seems to me that there may be some like acetobacter in there or something that, if you were to put a bunch of it into a barrel, you might wind up with 50 gallons of malt vinegar. A craft malt vinegar that you could try to sell outside your local Long John Silver's. I don't know.
Yeah, you'd be very popular at the local crab boil.
So there's a caveat that we found. So how do you make your own vinegar if you want to do it on purpose?
Nothing. You do nothing. You basically, with the black tea, or whatever tea combination you're using, it'll happen naturally. If you're making kombucha on a regular basis, there will be weeks you're like, I just don't want to look at that, and I'm a little bored with, refreshing my kombucha. And it will gradually evaporate a little bit. The SCOBY will get thicker, and it will keep adding more and more of an acidic character. And I'm sure the pH is dropping over time. And instead of refreshing it every week, if you check on it in 3 weeks or a month, depending on your level of neglect, you will find that it still, in my case, there's still some residual sweetness, but that it definitely gets very, very tart. And I've used my black tea kombucha and let it ferment to the point where it tastes like vinegar. And I have used it as sort of a soft replacement for malt vinegar. Doesn't have quite the same character, but it is neutral enough where on French fries or something, it does taste quite good. And despite all the literature, Sarah's kombucha has pomegranate and orange flavored tea, which is against convention of using unflavored teas. But what we've done with hers is that when that went a little long, I actually pulled some off, and then I put a whole orange zest in a big ball jar and added some sliced habaneros and just put it in there and did an infusion. And oh my, that was really tasty. We used that quite a bit.
Yeah, you're not supposed to use the flavored teas because of oils and stuff. Is that right?
Yeah. That's a theory, but ours, just like any, come on, you've been in the business a long time. There's been a lot of theories about homebrewing that have been debunked over the years. And I think that we use pretty cheap tea, and Sarah has used flavors that came recommended to her from a coworker, and we've never had any problems. Hmm. Oil or not, the fermentation seems to take place.
Are you still working on the same infusion of bugs that you had from the very beginning, or have you had to dump something out and start all over again?
No, actually, we still have the same population, and so we keep at least a minimal amount of it going, because I do like to feed my sourdough starter. My boys have discovered the joy of homemade bread, and so they really expect me to make it every weekend now, which is fine. And I do that, but I always, you know, go back to my kombucha starter to make sure that I've got the right character for my beer, my bread, my sauerkraut, whatever.
Wow. Well, it sounds like fun. It sounds like you're taking the homebrew spirit and spreading it across the food spectrum.
Well, it is the homebrew spirit, but it also is the spirit of laziness.
Which also is a component of the homebrew spirit. Why? Judiciously applied.
Right. Yeah. So basically, you have, if you're making kombucha, what you have is a liquid that is fully adaptable to a number of the other things that are likely to pique the interest of homebrewers, because they usually don't just stop at making beer. They start fermenting other things, pickles, sauerkraut, whatever.
And for those also new to the world of kombucha, you don't have to order an expensive kombucha online. You can just find a bottle of unfiltered, unpasteurized live kombucha at your local fancy schmancy grocery store, or it doesn't even have to be fancy schmancy. They had kombucha here in town, at the Harps at Prairie Grove, which you can see the little sediment at the bottom, and you just make a small batch of sweet tea, not as sweet as my sister makes it, but lightly sweetened tea, and then pour the whole bottle of kombucha in there, and pretty soon you'll be seeing stuff forming on the top. So it doesn't have to be hard.
No, not at all. I mean, I live in the suburbia area of Utah. I live outside of Salt Lake City. We moved out of the city several years ago. And I will say that our local grocery stores don't necessarily have the ingredients for as wide a palate as you would expect with a more diverse population. So even with that, like, I can't find horseradish or parsnips to save my life in my grocery store, but I can find bottled kombucha that is fresh and useful and perfectly capable of starting a fresh batch of kombucha.
Well, there you go. Well, Doug, let's not wait so long to get back together again.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. It's always a wonderful thing to talk with you and get caught up.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks again to Doug. We didn't go into a lot of detail on making kombucha or sauerkraut or kettle souring, but you can find all that stuff in our audio and video archives. But for those already familiar, I hope this conversation can inspire you to experiment and find more ways to combine your homemade tasty stuff. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Well, that's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.